KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco and live from our KQEI studios in Sacramento, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, African American and Latino students in the state of California continue to score lower than their white and Asian counterparts, regardless of wealth. We'll talk about the achievement gap in the hour ahead with State Superintendent of Schools Jack O'Connell in a panel and your calls after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco and from our KQEI studios in Sacramento, good morning. I'm Michael Krasny. The systemic gap between higher and lower performing students is the reason an Achievement Gap Summit has been called here in Sacramento by California Superintendent of Public Instruction Jack O'Connell. Last August, the superintendent asked for greater public attention to the achievement gap in education, which shows white and Asian students scoring higher than African and American and Latino students on state standardized tests. And that is whether the students are rich or poor, apparently. In some cases, white students outperform Latino and black students from middle class or wealthy families. So in this forum hour, we want to focus on what's going on in this achievement gap, what's behind it, and what needs to be done. And let me tell you who is joining us. Well, we're actually going to be joined by a panel, but first we're going to talk with Jack O'Connell. He's Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of California and organized this two-day Achievement Gap Summit being held here this week in the Sacramento Convention Center with, we should add, more than 4,000 education leaders, experts, and policymakers from across the country. And welcome, Superintendent.
Michael, nice to be with you, and thank you very much for the invitation and to be here with a couple of my good friends.
Whom we'll meet in just a few moments here. In fact, one of them was singled out by the superintendent as having considerable star power. I want to talk to you about what you've labeled as a crisis, a major crisis, in fact. We've got 56% of the state black and Latino. That's the state's future. You've called this conference, and you say you want to focus on it. I read like a heat-seeking missile beginning with the conference.
That's correct. I'm not going to use that term today, but it is a focus. It really is a crisis, and it's really been a call to action. We have an achievement gap. It's real. It's stark. It's persistent. It really does need to be addressed. Some of our fastest-growing subgroups are those subgroups that continue to comprise the students, so they're not doing as well as their Asian and white peers, and we need to do a better job. I think there are many contributing factors. It's a system, and we need to systemically make significant changes. Many of those changes have immediately come to the forefront at our two-day conference. I'm so pleased to have over 4,000 people. Every segment of the education community is well represented, as is the business community, labor community. We have elected officials that are here. People realize that this today is not just a moral imperative. It's not just a social imperative. Today it really is an economic imperative. And if we're going to remain the sixth or seventh or eighth largest economic engine in the world and remain on that platform as a state economically, we desperately need to address this crisis. And so I believe it's a moral imperative that we address this, and it's not just an educational issue. It really is a major issue for the state of California.
Well, some say it's just not a race issue. They say, in fact, it's economics. In fact, we talked to Ruslan Ali, for one, you know, from the African-American community, who said it's being separated too much into race. You have to see race working in tandem with poverty. Too much focus on race?
No, I don't think so. You can look at the data, and you will come to the conclusion, as I have, and have had many eyes looking at the data, both eyes within California and outside California, some of my friends and colleagues in other states. And when you look at the data, it's very clear that we have our white subgroup that comes from low socioeconomic backgrounds continues to do better than our African-American subgroups and our Latino subgroups that are not low socioeconomic. And so clearly there's been a disconnect in public education, and we need to make systemic changes. We need to make sure that we address the real issues that are contributing towards this achievement gap. It would be wrong to come to the conclusion that the achievement gap is exclusively a result of socioeconomic conditions in our society. Is that a contributing factor? Yes, but it's not the exclusive factor. And for far too long, far too many of us have portrayed that it's exclusively a result and a factor of socioeconomic conditions. And I also need to say, Michael, I don't believe the educational community in and of itself can solve the achievement gap. That's why I'm also pleased that we have representatives from the healthcare community, you know, across the street at our conference today. We're going to need to engage, you know, even to a greater extent, the business community. And we have representatives from the utilities that are here to learn and see what they can do to help. And then part of it is expectations. We had Tavis Smiley a little earlier today, and he talked so passionately about the fact that his second grade teacher, he was the only African-American from Indiana in a class, second grade class, out of 30 kids. And the teacher pulled him aside early in the year and said, you're not meeting my expectations, nor are you fulfilling your maximum potential. And so Mr. Smiley went on to talk about, he thinks of that second grade teacher every single day, a white woman. He visits her every time he returns home. He goes back for every holiday to see his family in Indiana. And she's in a nursing home. He knows when her birthday is. He communicates with her. And she is the one that said, you're not meeting your full potential. When we look at the statistics that Linda Darling Hammond puts forward, and she was one of our participants, and she's a friend, a researcher from Stanford, it's just clear that the system has let down far too many of our students. And we need to make some fundamental structural changes so that we can better prepare these students for success.
Well, let's talk about what some of those changes might be. And we ought to mention that we're talking, and I'm sure you would agree with this, about all students, because white students in California are also performing below the national average in almost all other states. And that in itself is something that suggests a real need of improvement overall. But we're talking maybe about the necessity of starting early, even in preschool, about changing the infrastructure, about all those things in the whole picture.
That's exactly right. And I agree with you. Our white students have to do better as well, but we need to accelerate that gap closure. And here's the good news. Our standards-based education is working. Everything that we've said, you'd think it might be a crumbling educational delivery system, and it really is working. Our test scores are up. More students in the class of 07 pass the high school exit exam than the class of 06, and we have more students eligible to attend our outstanding colleges and universities in this great state than we've had before. But that said, because of the competition from not just other states, but other emerging developing countries, because of the higher level of critical thinking skills and analytical skills that are going to be necessary in this hyper-competitive global economy, we know we need to do a much better job. Preschool, I've always thought, is going to be a key component of addressing the achievement gap. We know so much more today than we did a decade ago about the early development of the brain. And where we need to have the most quality preschool programs is where they're absent. They tend to be insufficient in helping us in many of these communities. The starting line is not the same for all students. We know that. The starting gate's not the same for everyone. So to the extent that we can help provide that. The most recent study by the RAND Corporation came out last week, and I read the summary and participated in the announcement with the RAND folks and the Packard folks who helped pay for it. And it simply says that students that are behind in terms of their preparation for success in kindergarten tend to remain so throughout their entire educational career. I mean, the dropout rate in California is unacceptable, and it's too much lost human potential. The most important capital we have in this state is human capital. And when we heard a great speaker at our conference talk about the investment in human capital, it needs to take place. So there are a host of issues. Some are going to carry a price tag. Some are not. And we need to make sure that we redouble, indeed retriple our efforts at making sure that we're preparing each student to meet his or her maximum success.
Well, let's talk about ways that that can be done. I think it's important that the public understand that, because this is a systemic problem, as you've been saying, inadequacy and inequality really across the board, across the whole state, mm-hmm. especially in the high proportion of African-American and Latino communities. Here's some of the things that have come to mind and that have been forward: more experienced and better trained teachers who have a rigorous, high-level ability to communicate in these communities. Getting kids perhaps to have teachers who have higher expectations, like you mentioned in Tavis Smiley's. I mean, in many of these communities, the teachers have lower expectations. That's just frankly the truth. And talk about different cultural backgrounds as well. There's been a lot of talk about that, about actually... there's a professor at Dominguez Hills I was reading, for example, who was pointing out that sometimes white teachers will look at a African-American student who's being in their mind, disruptive, who's being more energetic, perhaps expressing himself, those kind of cultural differences. And the tests. The tests are in complex language for many of those in the ethnic communities. Those seem to me the things that keeps rising to the surface as being the main kinds of things that we ought to be focusing on in way of solutions.
And we need to, and we will. And this is, you know, one of the steps towards helping to, you know, educate the educators and preparing all of us as a community. You know, I've often said it takes an entire community to educate a child. And that's never been more, you know, I think, an example than it is today. We heard one of the presenters yesterday, and it's he talked about the insensitivity of one of the teachers, a white teacher in a predominantly minority school, where the student came to school wearing his Letterman's jacket inside out and walked in. And the teacher said, "You're disrespecting the school when you do that." And the school colors happened to be red and black. And so he said, the neighborhood I have to walk through to get to school, if you're showing red, I would never get here alive. And so it's that kind of I have a friend that tells a story about a very engaging African-American church that the students go to. And the faith-based community is also represented at our summit, by the way. And they have to be part of the solution, in my opinion, to help. But my friend Glenn, Dr. Singleton, talks about a story with an African-American student in church that becomes very engaged, and it becomes, a shouting. And I've attended black churches before, and I've spoken, you know, from the pulpit on a couple of occasions. And it really is a great celebration, and very demonstrative and very vociferous. And then Monday morning shows up at school, and the teacher says, "Pass in your homework." And the student hollers, "Here's my homework," you know, all happy and that same type of engaging, and ends up spending time in the principal's office. And that's lost educational opportunity just because of that kind of a culture. So, you know, there's a lot that we need to do.
And we should be mentioning we'll be talking to Glenn Singleton shortly, in fact, who is here with us in studio, along with Jeannie Oakes, and we'll meet as well. We're talking now with Jack O'Connell, Superintendent of Public Instruction. By the way, Sacramento Bee said today that you're doing this achievement gap to boost your own political capital.
Well,
they quoted some people as saying that.
You know, and that is unfortunate and misguided. I mean, the achievement gap has been around for decades. And you won't find a political consultant in the world, in the planet, that will tell you that anybody doing this for political reasons is a smart politician. I'm going to give you the scoop of the day here. This isn't going to be solved by 2010. Can we begin to narrow the gap? Can we make those structural changes? Yes, and that's the goal. But, you know, when you're looking for quick sound bites, quick solutions, overly simplistic answers, and slogans, which too many leaders have given us over the years, trying to address the achievement gap in a very thoughtful, constructive manner and lead the state conversation that we've been able to do. And quite frankly, I think relatively successfully. It's an uneasy conversation to have, Michael. It's very difficult. It's difficult for a lot of us. I grew up in a low-income area and went back and taught at my alma mater, and it was predominantly minority school. I learned a lot, and I've learned a whole lot more over the course of the last several years serving as a state superintendent, having a chance to visit many of these schools and seeing many of these challenges firsthand. But I know what's at risk here. And the easy step would have been to go out and talk about, the gate kids. That's where all your voters are. But that's not the right thing to do for the state of California. The right thing to do for the state of California is make sure that we have an educational delivery system that we're proud of, that's preparing all students for success. And quite frankly, we're all going to benefit from that.
Well, I commend you for initiating this summit. I wish you good luck with it and hope that it bears a lot of fruit. And thank you for maybe by 2011 we'll have this thing done.
Thank you for having me.
Jack O'Connell, Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of California. And Glenn Singleton, whom I mentioned before, is here with us. He's Executive Director of the Pacific Education Group. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jeannie Oakes, who is Director of the UCLA Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access. And welcome, Jeannie Oakes.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Glad to have you as well. Let me begin with you, because last Thursday there was a California Opportunity Report that your organization released. And, no surprise, I'm afraid. Schools are segregated in many respects. These communities that we're talking about are much less served than Asian American students, than white American students. It's across the board like that.
Yes. At UCLA, we wanted to take up Superintendent O'Connell's challenge, and he asked for the state to focus on this racial achievement gap. And frankly, we were a little troubled because so many people seem to respond to this discussion as if the achievement gap is a cultural problem. that somehow there might be something wrong with African American and Latino communities that causes low achievement on standardized tests. And we knew, of course, that California has a much bigger problem than that because, as you said earlier, California's white students score far lower than students in other states. And yet nobody seems to be asking whether there's something wrong with California's white culture that's causing low achievement.
And so, let me just mention also, because it came out in your report, we're talking about American Indians here as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And so the cultural thing would have to apply to them if it were being applied or misapplied.
Absolutely. That's right. So we decided to dig a little deeper and to see if we couldn't come up with some explanations of this gap that went beyond simply looking to the families and the children themselves as being the problem. So what we did is we examined data, every place we could find data from across the U.S. and in California, and we basically found five things. First of all, there's the most important message is there's a fundamental opportunity gap that maps right onto the racial achievement gap, that you can see this mirroring of where there are achievement differences, there are differences in basic education resources. And that gap is both a national gap, so California, the gap between California and the rest of the country in basic education resources and conditions, and within California, a racial gap between what African American, Latino, and American Indian kids get in terms of education resources and white and Asian students. We also found that this is a very systemic problem. There's no place in the state that's free of this problem, and that we see it particularly if you look at the mathematics. One of the most challenging and important elements of our education system in terms of both the state's future and children's futures, that we have a terrible problem. And we note that because the exit exam requirement for the high school diploma, the consequences of these inequalities and inadequacies were much greater for the class of 2006 and will be for the class of 2007 than they have been in a decade.
Seems to boil down to resources in many respects. I mean, you want, at the top, I think, as I read your report, you want qualified and trained teachers, like we said with Superintendent O'Connell. You also want to improve the infrastructure. You want counselors. You want all these things that require smaller classes that really require money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, California, it's no accident that we're a state with too few resources when we're significantly lower than most other states in the amount of spending. We just haven't invested. And our California's big decline in education spending happened 30 years ago and can happen with highways and parks and libraries. If you don't spend for 30 years, you end up with a broken system.
It would be good to have the two-thirds done away with, wouldn't it? Just have a majority vote on educational bondings and so forth.
We are one of only two or three states that requires the two-thirds votes to increase resources and funding for schools or for anything in this state. And it would certainly be helpful if we could have a majority of Californians decide whether they wanted to spend more money on schools.
Jeanne Oakes again directs UCLA's Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access. Glenn Singleton is Executive Director of Pacific Education Group. He's also Adjunct Professor of Educational Leadership at San Jose State and previously taught at UC Berkeley on the topic of equity and education. Glenn, Jeanne mentioned the mathematic pipeline as being, you know, of preeminent importance. And again, we were talking to Ruslan Ali, and she was saying, I want rigor. I want high standards. I don't want students learning the elements through hip-hop or words to that effect. In other words, with all of the emphasis on cultural literature and cultural folklore and all of these kinds of things, are we disproportionately maybe not giving as much attention to something like math?
Well, I'm not sure that that's an actual dichotomy. I think that all of education is cultural. And the question is, whose culture? And so, you know, when I think about the broad aspect of this issue, it seems that in the forum should be, first of all, more people who have frankly navigated the system with the skin that I'm in as a black person and can comment on exactly what are those places and those points in the system that cause stress for us. But my life experience seems not to be the most valid part of my work right now. It's the part most often that is met with scrutiny and skepticism. But I do indicate that I've learned most from my own education. at the University of Pennsylvania as admissions director, I noticed right away that the best and brightest black students and brown students were challenged by the environment, by the culture. And so we weren't looking at low-income kids necessarily. We were looking at what were coming to us from some of the highest performing high schools and independent schools across the country. When I came to graduate school at Stanford, I had the opportunity to work with black and brown students in the Sequoia Unified School District. And those students, again, were struggling to get to higher education, part of the AVID program, part of the MESA program, getting supports that they needed, but continuing to meet an institution that didn't exactly have the highest expectations for them. Later, with the California Center for School Restructuring, I went deeper into high schools and also looked at the sort of lack of symmetry between the experiences that white students were receiving in California and the experiences that black and brown students were receiving. My first seminar on race was in 1995 in the state. We're still doing that seminar right now, Beyond Diversity. And what's amazing about it, Michael, is just how little understanding people have about race. You can't simply use the fact that we live each day as a indication that I get race. And so much of the conversation or the dismissal around the topic of how does race impact achievement disparities across the country is purely from an emotional place. And I think what we need to do is we need to investigate race the way that we have investigated issues like economic status, like language. And perhaps we need to recognize that we're not in a country that runs the risk of over-examining race.
Well, you mentioned Beyond Diversity, and I was curious to note that Robert Putnam, in fact, we had him on, the author of Bowling Alone, Harvard professor, was on with us talking about this whole new thesis that diversity actually works against many in smaller communities that we're talking about here.
Well, I think that when you try to analyze the way that people function, think, respond based on their cultural differences, whether that culture is religion, that culture is economic status, or that culture is race. I think that when you exclude any way of thinking about culture, you wind up biasing your understanding of the broader culture. I'll give an example. We once had a profound gender achievement gap. And the report now indicates that that gap is, if not closed, quickly closing. And that is to say that the statement is that girls are, in most cases, beginning to, if not already, outperforming boys. When you hear that across the country, it's missing an element. Black and brown girls are not outperforming. And in fact, that's what has happened in the diversity conversations in general. We have removed race from our conversation. And so as we relook then at these issues of diversity, whether they be gender or sexual orientation, what we wind up doing is looking at how the white mainstream understands these topics and lives these topics.
One of the ways they seem to understand it is, and I'd like you to maybe dispel some of this because I know you see it as undermining what you're all about, is teaching students, teaching advantages for students of color to somehow undermine white kids, that will be the net effect. I mean, that's the way many white people see it. I know you realize that.
Right. I think that is a one, it's a powerful illustration of racism. But secondly, it's a it's an important point where we have to note that when our white students in the state of California are actually educated with students of color, they will actually be more prepared for the kind of global stage that will be present in their lives. And if they're not taught by and sitting alongside students of color in the learning process, they will be in isolation.
Let's hold that thought because I want to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, you can do that now. Our toll-free number, where is it? I'm looking for the toll-free number here. Danny, can you give it to me or in my headphones? It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can join us on internet, if you're listening to us on radio, on internet, or on Sirius Satellite. We're in Sacramento at KQEI Studios in the state capitol. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the achievement gap. There's a summit here in Sacramento. We're live from KQEI studios in the state capitol. California's African-American and Latino students continue to score lower than white and Asian students on standardized tests. And we're looking at that this hour. We talked earlier with Jack O'Connell, who is superintendent of public instruction for the state of California, and he organizes two-day achievement gap summit. It's at the Sacramento Convention Center, by the way, with over 4,000 education leaders, experts, policymakers from across the country. Jeannie Oakes is with us in studio. She directs UCLA's Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access, and Glenn Singleton is executive director of Pacific Education Group, also with us in studio. We talked about Jeannie Oakes. I mentioned American Indians in this whole study, also in the group, who may get slighted a bit just because of their numbers. But what about Asians? I mean, one has to ask the question, why is this group performing so well as opposed to the Latino and Black groups? I mean, there's some obvious answers, but how do you read it?
Well, I think it's, again, it's a very complicated question that has to do with race, and it also has to do with opportunities. We found, and this surprises a lot of people, that about two-thirds of Asian students go to the schools in the state that are predominantly white and Asian. Very, very few students go to schools that are predominantly Asian students go to schools where most of their classmates are African-American and Latino. And the reason why that matters is that the schools that are majority white and Asian schools have far better resources. They have far better teachers. They have far more rigorous courses. They're subject to very high expectations. Here's a place where stereotypes may actually work in the favor of a group. But this combination of very high expectations and then much better resources. Certainly, it doesn't explain all of it, but it certainly explains some.
And how, Glenn Singleton, do we explain the fact that you've got African-American students who are in these schools who perform more worse than the white students do? I mean, we're talking about African-American students who have those resources that the Asian and white students have, who go to those schools, who are not in the communities that we're talking about that are largely Black or largely Latino.
I think that it's always a delicate line that we walk and consider when we're looking at how Asian American students are performing. First and foremost, to recognize that the Asian American group is a large conglomerate of many different groups. And so to be careful to look at the difference in experiences, historically speaking, of Chinese immigrants who by court of law petitioned for status as white. And so this is very much a part of the history of some of the Asian student populations. What you need to understand, I think, though, is that Asian American students, like other groups of color, experience racism. It's just a different form of racism. And so the idea of when an Asian student walks into a classroom and is expected to perform at a high level and needs support in math or science, and the teacher is distant from that student. I think the other thing that's noteworthy that was recently published in the Wall Street Journal looks at the Silicon Valley, where Asian students are outperforming white students, and those white families are choosing to move away from the Asian American communities, literally to orchestrate a new white flight. And so the Asian community is labeled collectively, which is a part of the racism, collectively as focused too much on education, and they study too much, whereas Black and brown kids don't study enough. And so by definition, that means that white families are doing it just right. Now, when we look at the data,
though,
it may
mean that there are cultural differences too, though, mightn't it?
But we're not calling them cultural differences, because we're still in an environment that proclaims itself to be racially neutral and colorblind. And so how interesting it is, though, that we notice when students begin to outperform white students that they become racialized, and racialized to the point of something that they're doing, which is actually higher level achievement, is seen as a deficit.
But again, the white students who outperform Black and Latino students are outperforming them, according to the studies I've seen, regardless of economics.
Absolutely.
And so, again, I get back to the question I asked before to when Jeannie brought up, you know, Asian students going to these schools,
sure,
with white students where there are more resources. What about the Black and Latino students who go to those schools and are availing themselves of more resources?
But I think that this is a critical part of the history, as I was saying. When a group is willing to attempt assimilation into the dominant culture, and that is to accept the curriculum as it's presented. This is who Columbus was. This is what he did. This is who Thomas Jefferson was. This is what he did. And when those stories continue to not include you at all, there's a more neutral experience. But we know that Thomas Jefferson had interactions with black people. That's not
very much so.
Exactly. And it's not listed in the history books in that way. And so when I write my test, I have to essentially proclaim Thomas Jefferson as his hero. That's going to hit the black conscious differently. That's going to hit the brown conscious differently when we look at the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
But are those going to increase scores in math and in reading? I mean, when you're giving those kinds of things to students and you're feeding them things that they can identify with, that they feel hits them at where they live, so to speak, in terms of their own skin.
Stimulates engagement. And that's
better education overall. You
that's
mean.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
We're going to go to our callers. But first, before we do, I want to bring Eric Hines into this discussion. He's a member of the board of directors of the CTA, the California Teachers Association, and also a fourth grade teacher at Willow Cove Elementary School in Pittsburgh, California. And the California Teachers Association is now up to about 340,000 members. Welcome, Eric Hines. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, what CTA's, talk about CTA's investment in this and what kind of programs they're looking at vis-a-vis the achievement gap.
Well, you know, CTA has always had a commitment to closing the achievement gaps, and one of the ways that we've shown this commitment is by our sponsorship of the Quality Education Investment Act, SB 1133. And this was a law that put $2.9 billion into the schools that needed the most to help reduce class sizes, hire some additional school counselors, and provide some quality training for teachers and principals.
And you're moving forward on that in what directions? I mean, where do you see it reaching, or where do you see it culminating?
Well, what we're hoping is that, you know, one of the things we know that of course, we have to have high standards for all students, and there's no single silver bullet. The challenges facing these schools, the higher percentage of more English learners, more Latino students, more African-American students, more students with parents who haven't graduated high school. You know, we're spending about $1,000 below the national average on public education. And these schools especially need the tools and the resources and these extra resources to succeed. In addition to that, these are richly diverse, you know, public schools, and the California teachers are sensitive to the cultural differences in these schools and of their pupils. In addition, CTA is also leading efforts to help teachers get training they need to teach English learners. And we're also working on another program to help educators recognize the unconscious bias and how it impacts relationships in the educational community. And what we're hoping is that by putting resources into these schools, we can show, and by providing the training necessary for educators and for administrators and providing local control, that these schools will help raise, it'll help raise student achievement for all students.
Well, does the notion of educating your teachers include having teachers have higher expectations in these schools for their students?
I think teachers overall have high expectations. What many of them are lacking are their resources and the tools to help their students succeed. And they things like working bathrooms, you know, roofs that don't leak. I mean, some very basic up-to-date textbooks, things like that.
And you back, then, Superintendent O'Connell's making this a centerpiece, or the union backs his making this a centerpiece of his administration strategy?
You're talking about the Quality Education Investment Act?
Well, no, about making the achievement gap, having the summit, and making it really the centerpiece right now of where he wants California to move.
Well, there's no silver bullet, and I know you've been talking a lot about race, and we agree with them. There's no silver bullet. We do need to have high expectations for all kids, and it's a little more complicated than just one issue, you know, because I think if we just focus on one, we're going to be ignoring a host of other issues and how they interact to create larger challenges for these decile 1 and 2 schools. But we're working very hard to change that and to close these gaps. But we need the resources and tools to do that.
I appreciate your being with us this morning. That's Eric Hines, again, a member of the Board of Directors of the California Teachers Association. He also teaches fourth grade at Willow Cove Elementary School in Pittsburgh. We're going to continue our discussion with our listeners. And, Lori, you're up first. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I am enjoying your show very much. I'm a longtime teacher. I'm now teaching at the university level. And I'm particularly appreciating Glenn Singleton's comments. I'd like to ask a couple of questions of Mr. Singleton. Number one, I'm working in teacher education now, and I'm in a doctoral program at USF. And I am particularly discouraged and particularly interested in how white privilege gets institutionalized in our teacher education programs. I'd like Mr. Singleton to comment on that. I've also experienced white parent resistance when I was working in the public schools for 20 years. I believe Mr. Singleton also mentioned curricular bias, which is profound, and I wish that would be discussed a little more on the program. And I'm interested in the fact that if 56% of our population is black and brown, why our curriculum does not reflect that.
Okay, Glenn Singleton.
That's quite a syllabus.
Those are
there.
formidable questions, to be sure. But let's talk about white privilege. It is pretty much institutionalized, isn't it?
Yeah, and I completely appreciate that that direct kind of conversation. I think that the first way we reinstitutionalize white privilege is that we simply don't talk about it. And so
All right, stay silent on this.
Right, exactly. I struggle in my own coursework at San Jose State with my students to make sure that this is a baseline for their interpretation of all educational theory that has been presented in what was believed to be a race-neutral way. So with the basis of understanding the pervasive whiteness of curriculum, which includes white privilege, but also includes just the sort of cultural expectations, groundings, norms, whatever the case may be, how we teach teachers to organize their classrooms, how we teach teachers to approach their students, to approach the parents, all of those things carry with them a cultural bias. And in this case, we're looking at the culture of race. And
there's a lot of content, too. You mentioned the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, for example. I mean, a lot of teachers just don't know about that.
Exactly.
They come out of social studies or history backgrounds, and they don't have any idea what it is.
And I think that that's probably one of the more difficult aspects of how do we catch our educators up on so much information that they need to have. And I think that there is a middle ground where we just have to invite our teachers to allow for the students to be more engaged in the process of discovering multiple interpretations and understandings of how history played out. It's always by the victor, you know, and so whoever won the battle gets to tell the story.
To the victor, the spoils, including history. I want to thank Lori for her call and go to another call. Jim, you're it. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to mention the idea that in today's world, it's much more about the class of the student, the socioeconomic class of the student, than it is about race. Also, test scores are way, way above where the kids, test standards are way above where the kids are actually at. And it's crazy. And the third thing is that it has a lot of this, the low performance of the kids has to do with the mother's education. And we just forget all these points. We don't seem to be able to focus on these real salient proven points.
Well, let me take your first point, because there's dispute about that. We heard Jack O'Connell opine on the fact that he thought race was preeminent and preeminent importance. Jeannie Oakes, let's get you on the record here. I mean, many people do bring up class and poverty and economic circumstances as being perhaps even more important than race, but that doesn't conform to your results, does it?
Well, the two are so intertwined that, in fact, it's a little bit silly to try to separate them out. Most of the black and brown students in the state are also very poor. That's not a coincidence. The same kinds of historical and structural forces that are at work that underlie these disparities we see in education performance are the same forces that underlie the disparities in wealth and income.
But
so,
there is a separation. I mean, even when the affirmative action debate was going on, there were many people who said, shouldn't be race, should be economics. Regard the colorblind, people are poor, working class, white, whatever.
It doesn't play out that way. The two are absolutely
inextricably
connected.
Yeah.
And even when you look at poor whites compared with poor black and brown kids in the data about school achievement, you have to remember that we use a very crude measure of poverty. We only use whether or not kids qualify for free or reduced price meals under the federal program. Well, under that program, you can have a family income up to 175% of the poverty level. Now, we know that the white kids who qualify tend to be at the upper end of that scale. and the black and brown kids who qualify are at the lower end. And that says nothing about wealth and generations of material advantages that also go along with race. I just think we're trying to fool ourselves. If we can figure out, if we think we can separate them out and just deal with one, and we'll have taken care of it.
The caller also said we're fooling ourselves on test scores, or at least that was certainly what he implied. Test scores, I think he suggested, are way above what the learning capacity or learning ability of so many students are. And maybe there is a mistake in, I wish Superintendent were still here, but, you know, teaching to the test scores or teaching to the tests. Many people have been complaining about that, and particularly since the Gray Davis administration, where tests became so pervasive. Some thoughts from either of you on that? Glenn Singleton?
I think that it's a whole different issue to examine testing bias. But I think that when you account for what we all understand as bias in testing, you still don't get that radical gap that we're experiencing. And so I would rather the conversation not go to the importance of examining standardized testing and go back to
coming up in this argument, that blacks and Latinos are being outperformed on the standardized test.
But that's the piece here, because we have essentially allowed ourselves to name this a achievement gap rather than looking at it as an educational gap, which includes then the disparity in access and opportunities, the disparity in resources, the disparity in expectations. And so what that also does is it allows us to blame the kids and, extension, blame the parents for what the system has never been able to do. We have a system that was designed to educate white kids, white males specifically. And so now to look at, 100 years later, and we see people blaming mothers. Well, I mean, these first immigrants from, Eastern and Southern Europe, their mothers didn't go to school. How did they succeed? And so we have many generations of mothers who were refused education. How did those folks all of a sudden become, executives in Fortune 500 companies? They are white.
You just answered the third question that the caller posed, and we're going to go to more callers. David, morning. You're on the air.
Morning. My comment ties in directly to what your guest just talked about. Asians predominantly were not brought to America against their will, and or became American against their will. Many American Indians and African Americans did not choose to become American. They were American by default. And with that, there is a certain sense of cultural isolation. I want to maintain my independence from you because you, as Malcolm X say, America landed on us. And you can see that today in, where African Americans do not get negative connotations within their community where they find success. The two most predominant things that I can think of right now are hip-hop music and sports. Both of these things came to existence after the abolition of slavery. When we look at how we become assimilated into the larger culture, we can look at how a family views themselves within the culture. If they still have a cultural resentment to the fact that they are American and they are where they are, they're not going to get those kinds of supports that they need, such as, family support for education. And if you look at Asian Americans, you can see that their families are very supportive of their education. Again, it can tie back to the idea that they came here by choice, predominantly.
Let me get some response, David, to your comments. Jeannie Oakes?
Well, I think it's, if you look historically at African Americans and even prior to the Civil War, Education has been one of the strongest values in that community. It was illegal, of course, to teach a slave to read. And yet you hear story after story of people hiding away, risking their lives or their fingers, if they write, to become literate. And I think that the one thing we forget is that African Americans have always equated education with freedom and to be part of the struggle, to be fully part of this society. And I think that strong core of value for education is so disregarded by so many in the white culture who say, well, they just really don't care about education or they don't support education. It's just historically
accurate. I mean, you hear people like Bill Cosby saying, you know, he's talking about a certain segment within the African American inner city, for example, and saying they don't care enough about education. You hear it from Al Sharpton. You hear it, in other words, from often self-proclaimed black leaders that there isn't enough emphasis on education. Remember that whole campaign where they had people from the African-American community coming out and saying, you know, don't, including, you know, some athletes saying, don't try to be necessarily an athlete. If you're going to be a rocket scientist, be a rocket scientist, trying to emphasize, in other words, education over sports.
Well, I know there's a lot of talk about that, but when you look at, say, public opinion polls of minority communities, you find comparable rates of parents saying that they want their children to graduate from high school, go on to college, and get at least a college degree. That African Americans and Latino parents say that at exactly the same rates as white and Asian parents say it. So the data don't seem to bear out what many people have found to be sort of compelling anecdotal arguments.
We need more data, by the way. We need more data about high school completion, about college enrollment. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on those scores. But let me bring more of our calls in. Cheryl, morning.
Good morning. I have a bit of a perspective on the Asian student. I lived in China for a number of years and tutored a number of students there. And the family, from the time kids are young, the family teaches a child that if you're not doing well in school, you just work harder. You get up earlier, you study harder. You still don't do okay, you stay after school, you work late at night, you work on the weekends, and you study harder. And I think it teaches the individual that the achievement is up to you. It's not external to you. It's within you. And the family will also mobilize their resources. And a lot of these are very poor, very, very poor people. And they will do without a lot of things to help their kids. They turn off the TV. They have books. They buy them, you know, whatever they need for schools. And the schools there are pretty minimalistic, you know, without many extras at all, if any.
But you're talking about a work ethic, a very strong work ethic and emphasis on education.
Yes, but it comes from the family. And yeah. And I've seen in, you know, my own relatives and people around me and neighbors. I have a neighbor whose daughter just began first grade, and yet she doesn't go to bed till 11 o'clock or midnight on a school night, and they wonder why she's getting bad marks already in school.
Let me ask Glenn Singleton to address this. It's the second time it's come up about the family and keeps rising here in the conversation. Some thoughts?
I want to draw first a quick parallel, and that is I've visited schools in Ghana and in Ethiopia, and I see that exact same connection and, if you will, work ethic towards education, and these are of Africans. The very important thing, I think, that we need to differentiate here is there's a difference between education and schooling. And there has been no loss in the community to be educated. In fact, our kids continue to make, our kids, when I say black kids, continue to advance in music, continue to advance in all kinds of creative aspects, which this country finds highly profitable. So the point is, do our kids feel welcomed and included in the process of schooling? Schools are hostile places to black and brown children and American Indian children. And I think that it's unfair and unfortunate that a country continues to ask kids to come to school and exist in a place that hasn't expressed interest or appreciation for the kids and their families. And so I think we need to move back and look. The system of education in the United States is primarily delivered through K-12 or pre-K-12 schooling, is not yet conducive to the diverse populations that are in this country. And until we begin to have a conversation about how schools become places of support and nourishment for all of our kids, not just the kids for whom the institution was designed to support, but for all of our kids, we will continue to have kids disengage and their families disengage from the process of schooling.
I'm asking you this, and I don't know if you have any more of a beat on it than anybody else, but is it, I mean, you're talking about racism, institutionalized racism, systemic racism. Is it worse for blacks than it is for Latinos?
It's really hard to measure whether it's worse. I think that when you continue along the lines of examining whiteness and white privilege specifically, I think that the darker your skin, the greater your challenge. And so black and or African-American and Latino become a blurred distinction because Dominicans can be quite dark. Puerto Ricans can be quite dark. And so what we've discovered is that as kids are racially identified, not white, we see a challenge in their process of education or schooling.
Tommy, let's bring you on to Forum. Good morning.
Hi, Glenn. Tommy, how you doing?
Good to hear you, Tommy.
I just want to, there are a number of things that I could talk about this morning, but I want to challenge the state to start looking at programs that are working effectively with black and brown kids. And the Beyond Diversity is one of those programs that is doing tremendous things. How can the teacher teach in a classroom and without knowing themselves first?
Yeah, we should find out more about the program so our listeners know. Glenn, you want to address that, if you would?
Well, Beyond Diversity is a foundation seminar that introduces educators to the basic notions of race and begins with, as Tommy's indicating, a personal exploration of race in my life and takes them into or through the discussion of racial dominance and whiteness and then looking at systemic racism as connected to schooling.
And on that note, we're going to have to conclude, but I want to extend thanks to Glenn Singleton, who's been with us for the hour, Executive Director of the Pacific Educational Group, and also a professor at San Jose State University. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Also, our thanks to Jeannie Oakes, who is Director of UCLA's Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access.
Thank you.
And thanks to Eric Hines, who also joined us this half hour, a member of the Board of Directors of the California Teachers Association and a fourth grade teacher at Willow Cove in Pittsburgh, and Jack O'Connell, who was with us the first part of the hour, the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of California. Thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we appreciate your being with us here. We hope every day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. And we want to also thank our engineers, Danny Bringer here in Sacramento and Dave Freeman over in San Francisco, and our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. And we also want to thank our production assistant, Tina Lauerberg, and our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.